It seems to me that we find a pattern of the way that God often works. You can read through the Hebrew Bible, you can read through the New Testament as well, and that pattern seems to prevail often. That God is not often in people's face. God is actually very patient. God is actually willing to wait and allow people to notice where God is and what God is doing. It's interesting to me that when you read through the Gospels, it's very often that people come to Jesus rather than Jesus going to people. Now, Jesus sometimes does go to people, to individuals and to groups of people. But more often than not, Jesus is just going about what Jesus is doing and people gather. People come. You remember the story on the Sea of Galilee? They got on the boat, went across the other side. People came. People gathered because they sensed that there was something different about this person. Something significant was going on here. Skip down to verse 7. And after a brief introduction to Moses, Moses is getting some kind of idea of what he's encountering in this burning bush. From verse 7 through to verse 9, we see a description of God, a self-description of God, which says, I've observed, I've heard, and I've come down. I've observed, I've heard, and I've come down. This is God's response to oppressive suffering. Now, there should be some clues for us here. First of all, just let me address the issue of coming down, because in the ancient world, of course, they believed that God or gods were up there. Now, we might not necessarily think that today. We may have a sense that God is everywhere. But in the ancient world, there was this idea of God coming down. So God communicates to Moses in a language that Moses can understand. So Moses lives in a world where God's come down from above. That's exactly what God says. I've come down, I've observed, I've heard. What's more important, though, is what God is responding to. Because I reckon that God observes and hears all sorts of things, even today. But what's interesting here is that it's the oppression, the misery, the suffering of people that is the thing that has provoked God into coming down, observing, hearing, seeing, and doing something about it. There's a clue there. What gets God moving? When God sees suffering, oppression, and misery. That's what gets God moving. It's certainly according to Exodus chapter 3. So on the one hand, Moses is experiencing a mysterious, perhaps rather evasive God, we might say. But on the other hand, Moses has experienced a God who's willing to come down into people's life, into people's lived experience, and to do something about this particular issue of oppression and slavery. This is the same God who has been revealed in the scriptures before this. It's the same God that will be revealed in the scriptures after this. But this is a particular occasion, a particularly important occasion, because the Hebrew people are suffering and because God reveals God's name for a special purpose. And by the way, I should say there's a rabbinic midrash on this story which says that God actually told the angels to stop celebrating over the suffering of the Egyptians a bit later on in the story, because we've got to think about that as well. This wasn't just a story of the suffering of Hebrew people. This was God addressing the suffering of the Hebrew people as a pathway to addressing the suffering of all people, every people group of every generation of every time. Well, so far so good, as we said. God has revealed something to Moses. Moses has had enough nous to pay attention to what's going on and is trying to figure out what it means. And I guess for Moses, he might have thought at this point, well, so what? What does this mean? God, you've seen the suffering of people. You've come down to do something about it. What do you expect me to do? I'm hardly going to go back to Egypt. I mean, I'm all but a convicted murderer in that place. It would be a risk of my life that I would go back there. Of course, at this point, he doesn't know that that's what God is going to suggest. But he might have these kinds of questions running through his head. But then the reality hits hard for Moses. He remembers the story of hardship. And remember I said earlier in the story, in Exodus chapter 2, one of the reasons that he killed someone was because he was so angry about the oppression, the slavery that he was seeing. It's just sad that his anger manifests itself in murder, which in the situation, well, we could argue in any situation, is very, very unhelpful and very destructive, certainly to the life of the person who dies. But Moses, nonetheless, felt for his people, and God seemed to be connecting with what Moses was feeling. What's interesting again here is that God probably could have done this by God's self. I would think if God wanted to go and deliver the Israelite people, the Hebrew people, God could have done that. But God chooses, rather than doing that, to actually work through Moses. Now, we said before, Moses was far from a perfect person, just like Abraham and all the other characters that came before, Sarah and Rachel, and the list goes on. None of them were brilliant people, so to speak. None of them are highly moral people, but God used them. And that's exactly what God is intending to do in this case. And again, that sets a pattern. You might remember Jesus feeding of the 5,000. There was a couple of accounts of feeding big groups of people. But the interesting thing is that Jesus, in that case, puts the food into the hands of the disciples. And it's the disciples who divide up the bread and, in a sense, do the miracle. Isn't that interesting? Jesus could have gone round and handed it out. Probably would have taken longer because it was only one of him. But he could have done that. And he could have said, see what I've done? And there's all this leftover stuff. But he didn't do that. He gave it to the disciples. And he said, you go and do it. In other words, you propagate the miracle that has ultimately come from God's self. Well, Moses' response is interesting. And this is where we get to the core of what I want to talk about this morning, this idea of name. Because Moses says, who am I that I should go? Who am I that I should go? Have you ever said that? I've said that a few times over my life. Who am I that I should go? Who am I that I should do this particular thing? But the response from God is really interesting, because essentially what God says is it actually doesn't matter who you are. The most important thing is who I am. Who I am as your God. And who I am as your God will be the driving force, will be the fuel, will be the energy for you to do what I want you to do. What God does say in the first instance is, I will be present with you. And that's always very comforting. Again, reflecting on some of the thoughts that Ross has shared with us this morning. One of the wonderful things that we often read in the Psalms, and we read it there, we prayed it there in Psalm 73, is the recognition that even though you're going through the deepest and most difficult and toughest times that life could present to you, there's a sense that God is with us. That's incredible. That is an incredible gift that people of faith have that I think we sometimes take lightly. And certainly my encounters with people in life who don't have faith and yet find themselves in those same very deep places, it's that much more difficult. Now, I'm not saying it's not difficult for a person of faith. It definitely is. But it's that much more difficult without that sense of God's presence with us. So Moses is having this thought reinforced that it will not be easy going into Egypt and undertaking this task, but God will be present. God will be with Moses as he does that. God's response to the request for a name is very interesting. It's gracious, it's a gift, but it's also enigmatic. It's not easy to understand. I want to suggest to you that God is a verb, not a noun. I don't know if you've ever thought about that concept. God is a verb. God is an action rather than being thought of as an object. And the reason I say that is because of the name that God reveals to Moses here at the burning bush. But before I talk about that exact name, I just want to talk about some of the enigmatic aspects of this. There was a risk for God in giving Moses God's name. And the major risk was that in the ancient world, people actually believed it was important to know the names of their gods because then they could control them. Some people think that today as well. I've certainly been in plenty of Christian contexts where people think, oh, I know God, so I can manipulate God. to do what I want God to do for me. So it's not an old problem. It's not a new problem. And so in giving Moses a name, there was a risk for God. Not that God could be controlled, but that Moses would think that he could control God. But still, God takes the risk. But it's an interesting theme as well, isn't it? You know, God's a risk-taking God. God often does this. God picks, you know, people that we probably wouldn't pick. God does things that we possibly wouldn't do, but God does these things in just wanting to work with human beings and wanting to work with creation. Now, volumes and volumes have been written on Exodus 3, 14 and 15, this divine name. And I'm going to try and sum that all of that up in about 2 minutes and see how I go. So here are some things that we can say about this name. You might have noticed that when I was reading this passage, I actually read it as I will be who I will be. Most of your Bibles probably say I am who I am. Some of your Bibles will footnote that with I will be who I will be. And I'll talk a little bit about that as we go through. The words used here, etymologically, so in terms of where they come from in terms of vocabulary, they come from the verb hayah, which means to be or to become. And so it can be translated as I am who I am, but it's most likely better translated as I will be who I will be. And that's why I suggested to Ross that I entitle this sermon God's Dynamic Presence. Because what I mean by that is that God is dynamically present in creation ever since the beginning of time, even before that. Whatever was before was also God's dynamic presence. It's part of the nature of God. But what's challenging about this, and I think it's one of the reasons why Bible translations continue to translate it as I am who I am, is because theologically people often talk about God as being immutable, unchangeable. God is always has been. God is and God always will be exactly the same. When you start translating it as God will be who God will be, well, hang on a second, that opens up a few challenging possibilities. Well, I'm just going to leave it as it is. See, I'm a biblical theologian, so for me, my theology arises from the biblical text. So the biblical text allows that to be. And I'm kind of very attracted to that because what it suggests to me is that God is not some immutable, immovable, unchangeable force that always has to do things the way God has always done them and always has to be revealed in the way God has always been revealed because God never changes. But God is actually so dynamic that God can become what is necessary for the particular circumstance. Now, let me give you a very obvious example. Here we're talking about God revealed in the burning bush. What happened in the New Testament, God is revealed in the person of Christ. That's a dynamic God, a God who can be revealed in multiple ways. God is not limited to particular ways of being revealed. And so it preserves this sense of God being able to be what God wants to be. One translator has translated it this way: I will choose to be what I will choose to be, or who I will choose to be. And again, that reflects this idea that God can be dynamic in different situations. Does it mean that God changes in God's character? No. God's character of love, grace, and mercy is something that we can see consistently through the scriptures and through history. But it's not God's character that changes, but the way in which God works, way God reveals God's self is something that is incredibly dynamic. So, my summary of that is it's rather unfortunate that most of our English translations just have I am who I am. For Moses in this situation, the name here suggests something important, and that is that God's mission in this instance is to set the people free from their oppression and slavery. And God will be who God will be in doing that. Now, this is interesting. If a name in some way sums up the kind of person or the kind of entity that God is, then in this case, the kind of God that we're talking about is a God who releases people from slavery. That's God's intention. This God is present, grounded in the lived experience of these people. Because God also says to Moses, don't forget I'm the God of your ancestors, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. In other words, I have a history. I mean that in the best sense of the word. I have a history with these people. This goes back a long, long time. And finally, Moses and the Hebrew people will see this in the ultimate battle between God and Pharaoh. Now, like I said, in that midrash, that interpretation, let's not laugh and be joyous because of the suffering of the Egyptians. That's not what this story is about. This story is ultimately about the release, the liberation of all peoples. But in this case, the narrative focuses on Pharaoh and Yahweh, Pharaoh and God. Because for the Egyptians, who was Pharaoh seen as? Not just the king, but also as their God. And so it becomes a question of, well, and this sounds very probably crass for us in our world, I guess, but who has the most powerful God? I mean, in the ancient world, that's pretty much how it functioned. If I win a battle, then I can say my God is victorious and I worship the true God. So here, it was a kind of a battle, if you like, between these two gods. So there are a whole lot of things that Moses was revealed to, a whole lot of things that were revealed to Moses at the burning bush. Not just the name of God, but something about the nature and the character of God. I want to finish with a few reflections based on those thoughts that I've suggested to you today. And I think that these reflections are important for us to consider today as followers of Jesus, because many of these themes, many of these patterns follow through into the New Testament and also for us. Remember how Moses noticed and turned aside to the burning bush? A wise friend of mine, probably, I'd say in my experience, he's probably who I would consider to be the wisest friend that I have, an older gentleman. He said to me several years ago, we were talking about this story, and he said to me, you know, every bush is burning. I said, what do you mean every bush is burning? But when being a wise person, a bit like Jesus in a way, you know how Jesus didn't often explain himself. He just said it and let people go and figure it out for themselves. Well, my wise friend did the same thing. He just said, go away and think about it, consider it. And I went away and prayed about it, thought about it and considered it. And I realised there was a real truth in what he was saying. What he was saying was that our world is full of burning bushes. Our world is full of things that we ought to be paying attention to, turning aside, drawing aside, to look at, to consider and to learn from. So the question was not, is there a burning bush or how many burning bushes there are, but do I actually notice them? I dare say every one of us in this room walk on our daily journey, both literally walk and our journey beyond that, and pass many, many burning bushes that we don't even notice. I know that's true for me. Maybe you're more astute than I am. Maybe you're more attuned to what God is doing. I hope you are. But for me, I often have to actually stop myself and say, pay attention. What's going on here? What's God doing in this person's life? What's God doing in this situation? Which bush is burning and what is that burning saying to me? I think my friend was right. Maybe not every bush is burning, but there are a lot of burning bushes out there. And the question is, do I notice them? It seems to me that Jesus was a keen observer of burning bushes. Even in the cut and thrust of life, in the busyness of life, Jesus was able to notice the important things. You remember when he was on the way through the crowd and someone touched his garment? Now, he could easily have, I mean, I imagine, having you've all been in crowds before, it's not easy to know if someone has touched you, brushed against you or whatever. And often it happens numerous times. I remember a few years ago I was in Seoul in Korea, 23 million people. You can't help but be touched by people when there's that many people around. And it was interesting in that situation with Jesus that he stopped and said, who touched my garment? There was a burning bush. He knew of all the brushes and everything else that had probably happened in that huge crowd, he knew there was something significant about that particular one. I remember the story of blind Bartimaeus. I think I've spoken to you about that before. When Jesus is going through Jericho and everybody else is ignoring, in fact, everybody else is telling this guy to shut up, just stop screaming out, just sit on the side of the road like you're supposed to do as a blind person. Say nothing. But Jesus stops because for Jesus, Bartimaeus was a burning bush. It was God presenting an opportunity. And the question is, do we see them like Jesus saw them? Well, I don't think any of us are quite that like Jesus. We probably will miss opportunities. But if we're attuned, there's a chance that we may see some of those. Second, I find the explanation for God's revelation to Moses very enlightening here. This God who observes, who hears the cries of anguish, who comes down to do something about it. This is the God that we worship. And if you want to see the ultimate example of that, look at the life of Jesus. If God is a God who hears the cries of anguish, who responds and who comes down, then the incarnation is the clearest example of that. A friend of mine, not so long ago, was asked by an atheist, what is the best proof that that God existed? And his response was, Jesus. Because Jesus was God in the flesh. And the ultimate example of God of the burning bush. You might remember in Luke chapter 4, in the synagogue, Jesus unfurls the scroll, as was done in the culture, and reads from Isaiah, interestingly enough, the Spirit of the Lord, the God of the burning bush. That's not what it says in Luke 4, I'm just adding that in. The Spirit of the Lord, the God of the burning bush, is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour. God has been in this business for a long time. God has been in the business of liberating people since the beginning of time immemorial. What does that mean? Well, in very simple terms, it means people finding their way back to God. But in more detailed terms, it often means people being released from oppression. And that can be all sorts of things. It can be physical slavery, like we've talked about here. It can be poverty. It can be physical disability. It can be all sorts of things. Does it mean those things will go away, that God will take them away? Well, sometimes, but sometimes not. But what it does mean is that people in those situations can discover God. So for a blind person, does it mean the blind person will always be healed? Maybe, maybe not. But what it does mean is that that blind person will find God in their disability. This is the promise of the burning bush. This is the desire and the work of God, that God would set people free, that God would see that people could connect with God. But the interesting thing is the way God achieves this is most often through ordinary people like you and me. Well, maybe you're not ordinary. I'm ordinary. But just through ordinary people like you and me. It's like Jesus putting the loaves and fishes into the hands of the disciples and say, you feed them. You do the miracle. You be the presence of God. I love the story of Mother Teresa when she was interviewed several years ago. And one of the questions was, why do you do what you do? And she said, because when I see a destitute person in the gutter, I see Jesus. I see the face of Jesus. So her compassion for the people that she worked with, her graciousness, her love, her mercy was a reflection of a God who comes down, who hears the cries of anguish, who wants to do something about the situation. God working through us rather than independently of us. Jesus passing his mission on to his followers. Remember, Jesus, towards the end of his ministry, said, greater things will you do than those that I have done in this world. That's an example of Jesus handing the ministry on to those around him. In Exodus 3, God also sends Moses with a promise, and God goes with Moses to fulfill that promise. No one is alone in the work that God has called them to undertake. Like we said before, there are times when we might feel alone. And it's important, as we've done this morning, to be able to express that. One of the things that I love, and those of you who know me know that I believe this to the bottom of my heart, that God is delighted when we're prepared to express that sense of feeling abandoned. God is okay with that. But the assurance we can have is that even in those deepest of times, God is with us. Would Moses have experienced that? Yes, absolutely. And in fact, not just in Egypt, but if you follow the story through in the rest of Exodus and into Deuteronomy, you'll know there were many times. I was doing some work recently for a conference paper on Numbers 11, and Moses confronts God and he's absolutely bereft of everything. He's despairing of these people because they just complain about everything, and says to God, you know, who gave birth to these damn people? Well, damn isn't in the biblical text, but I'm sure it probably could have been very easily. He was incredibly frustrated. But through all of that, there was this underlying sense that God was present. Isn't it interesting? In his despair and his frustration, what does he do? Does he beat himself up? Does he, he turns to God. And he said, God, you've given me these people. What am I supposed to do with them? He recognized God's presence. As Kierkegaard once said, better to shake your fist at God than turn your back on God. And that's exactly what Moses did. That's exactly what so many of the characters in the biblical text do. We see it with, we mentioned Naomi earlier. Another example of someone who turned to God in her despair, in her bitterness, because that was the only thing that she could turn to. The catch, of course, is that while we cry out to God, typically God responds through people, through you and through me. God's nature is manifest through us as individuals and communities. As someone once said, the only church some people will see is you. They will never come into a building like this or any other kind of building where a worshipping community meets, but the only church they will meet is the one that they meet in the car park or the shopping centre or at your front door of your home or in your workplace or in your place of study. That's the only church that people will meet. We are the hands and feet of God. As someone once said, we are the resurrection of Christ. You know, we might talk about the death and resurrection of Christ as we have done this Easter time, every Easter time. But let's remember that you and I are the resurrected Christ. We have Christ living in us. And so we are called to live the character of God. We are called to live the God of the burning bush. So I hope and pray that as you go about your daily life and whatever that entails, in your homes, in your workplaces, your places of study, where you socialise, when you're down at the shops, wherever it happens to be, that there would be something evident of the grace of Christ in your life. And when you see those burning bushes, you would pay attention, but not just pay attention, you'd turn aside and just see if you can hear God's voice. What is it that God is wanting from me?